Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a woman who, for more than 10 years now, has been anchoring the ITV News and, more recently, Loose Women. She's also just made a really fascinating documentary for ITV's Black History Month called Empire's Child that sees her uncover her genealogy as a Black Briton of Jamaican origin, tracing her family's roots to establish quite how the British Empire shaped her history. She makes some very surprising, emotional and at times difficult discoveries, most notably that her five times great-grandfather was a slave owner in Jamaica who'd had illegitimate children with women on his plantation, and that her four times great-grandparents were born into slavery but were also amongst the first Jamaicans to be freed and unslaved. Her own parents arrived in the UK in the 1960s from Jamaica as part of the Windrush generation, and she and her two siblings were raised in Greenwich, London. After leaving school, she studied journalism and took on an apprenticeship at ITV News before joining the newsroom at Radio 1 and Radio 1 Extra in 2002, where she once famously had to kick John Legend out of her seat to get her news bulletin out on time. In 2008, she joined ITV News as an anchor, where she's been ever since, and in 2014 became the first Black woman to host the news at 10. She still lives in London with her partner Andy and their two young children, Alfie and Florence. So let's dial her up. I'm looking forward to this. It's Charlene White.
Hello, Kay.
Hello, hello. How are you? We've just been reminiscing offline about the one and only time we met on a dance floor.
Yeah, and I feel like every single one of the stories we were just sharing completely inappropriate for this podcast.
Totally, which is why we're not sharing them. Some conversations are meant to be kept private.
Absolutely.
And yet here you are all these years on. 2014, you make the history books as the first Black woman to host the news at 10. Number one, shocking that it took so long.
Yeah.
Number two, bloody well done.
Thank you. Do you know what? I didn't realise that it was when I did it, and that's probably a good thing. It's the one and only time in my life where somebody has seen something in me that I didn't see in myself. So when my boss called me, my boss Robin, who I shout from the rooftops because he was a massive supporter of mine and still is, even though he's retired, he called me to ask, and he was like, "Hi, Charlene. We've got a gap in the rota for News at 10 coming up in about 2 or 3 weeks, and just wondered if you'd like to do it." The problem was, Kate, is I'd been in an awards ceremony all day, so I'd been on Prosecco and champagne. Yeah. for hours. I then left the award ceremony to go to a leaving do around the corner from work. And by that point, I'd had another two gin and tonics. And then my boss calls. So when he said that to me, I couldn't quite get my head around it. I'm like, oh, right. Okay, Robin. Wow. Gosh, that sounds incredible. But I've got to be honest with you, Robin. I've had quite a bit to drink. So I can't actually really decipher exactly what's going on. I tell you what, how about I come into your office tomorrow and we talk about it some more? And Robin knows it very well. He was like, okay, Charlene, I'll see you at 10 o'clock.
That's for the best.
All right then, thanks, bye.
Did you remember it when you woke up?
Well, I was in a bit of shock and I rang my dad and my dad was like, oh, he's very unstable. And he was like, oh, yes, that sounds amazing. And then I called my friend Jack and she squealed. And she went, so what's going to happen? I went, I don't really know because I didn't bother finishing the conversation. But we'll talk tomorrow. And then went in and, of course, it was real. And it was amazing. I mean, it's so me. Robin knows me so well. So it didn't come as any shock to him whatsoever that I couldn't discuss me doing news at 10 because I was drunk. And then went in and spoke to him about it. And he was wonderful. And actually, on the day, I didn't know that I was the first one. All I wanted to do that day is I work, as I'm sure you have done as well, I work with around the most amazing people in our newsroom. And from the moment they realised that I was going to be presenting news at 10, they were, and it just literally came together to almost lift me to make sure that I felt like I could do it.
How lovely.
Julie Etchingham sat me in the studio with her one afternoon and ran through everything with me and talked me through how news at 10 works. Every single person on the production team had my back and they were like, you can do this, you'll be brilliant. Michael in graphics brought his stills camera in and documented the day for me taking pictures. And when it came to actually, and Mark Austin, who I did it with that day, sat with me to do all the writing and everything and made sure I was okay. And then sat in that studio. And I think I was less nervous about doing it for me. I think the nerves came from, I just wanted to make sure that I made them proud because they were amazing. And I think it's not every day you get to work in a newsroom where you get such a huge amount of support. And when I said the goodbye and the camera stopped rolling, they all, God, I get emotional even talking about it now. When the camera stopped rolling, they all came into the studio and clapped. Which was amazing. You know.
But you know what? That says a lot about you, Charlene, because we've all seen people that we think karmically maybe didn't deserve the promotion that they often go on to acquire. That doesn't sound like that was the case with you. It sounded like your colleagues really wanted to elevate you because you deserved that opportunity.
Bless you.
I want to give you a hug through the screen.
Thank you. That's major.
How lovely that that moment is so clear in your mind as well.
Oh, like it was yesterday. And it was a former chief exec at ITV came over to my desk the next day because he happened to be in the building. And he literally just popped his head over and he said, oh, you know, you made history two nights ago, don't you? I went, really? He went, yeah. He says, you're the first black woman to have ever presented News at 10. He's went, I'm very proud of you. That was the first time I knew. Because I'd assumed someone had come before me. I just assumed.
Yeah.
You know, it was 2014.
Well, what with it being 2014 and everything, you'd have bloody hoped, right?
I just assumed and I didn't know. And I was just in so much shock. I didn't realise.
You nailed it and you've been nailing it ever since.
Okay, thank you. I just have said it's going to be really embarrassing, but to have you say that does mean a lot to me. It really does.
Oh, don't. Bless it. No, listen, I can't believe that, you know, you've gone on to sit there and anchor the news at 10, the programme, the one programme of the day that I never miss. Even if I'm not home at 10, I still watch it before I go to bed.
Yeah.
It's the most trusted news source for me, and that puts you at the heart of it. That is the ultimate journalistic honour, is it not?
Oh, bless you. Yeah, it really, really is. And, you know, it's a slightly different programme, obviously, now that it's single-headed, and I loved working with the guys that I work with when it was double-headed. But it is the show, you're right, it's the show that everybody sits and watches. It's a thing, you know? And
throughout the pandemic, it was more important than ever. I think it absolutely helped to make people realise the true value of great journalism.
Yeah.
Great journalism, not just everyday kind of knock it out on the internet journalism.
No,
now listen, this all brings me very nicely to my first question. I've had a chance to explore your family history with you. I mean, the documentary was phenomenal. Congratulations on Empire's Child. a real genuine voyage of discovery. But I know that when we work back to your choice of profession, that was born in part from the affirmation that you had for your mum and your aunt, who your mum worked as a social worker, your aunt was a teacher.
Yeah.
And they worked in roles that enabled them to speak up for the voiceless, to improve the lives of the people they were there to help.
Yeah.
And that inspired you to want to tell the stories of those whose voices are not heard. But I wanted to know, of all the stories you've worked on, uncovered or told, which has touched you and taught you the most and why?
Oh, gosh, there's there's a question.
And that's hard, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh, there's a question. I think the first thing that comes to mind would be the Haiti earthquakes, actually, because it was the first story that really hit me here. And it was because it was the Caribbean. It's because it was people suffering in such an awful way who looked like me. And, you know, the history of Haiti, and when you go back to the amount of different countries that have owned it and then just left it in the state that it's in, it really did hurt. And there are ways, what annoys me sometimes more than anything is the way that we treat human bodies when we're dealing with news. If you come from particular areas of the world and your skin is lighter, for instance, there's certain things they'll blur. They'll blur a lot of the cuts, the bruises, the death. They'll blur a lot of that because it's seen as being a lot more tasteful. But then you may well see the bodies of those who have darker skin, and it's not perhaps treated in the same way in terms of broadcast journalism.
Same reverence and respect is not afforded to those victims.
Yeah.
That's a disgrace.
And you can, you know, once you sort of are aware of that, the way that you look at sometimes news stories are treated, you get that disparity. And especially when it came to Haiti earthquakes, for example, and I was on the 5:30 news at that point, and there are certain shots that I wouldn't use when I'd be editing down packages. There are certain images that I'd make sure were blurred because I see that as being hugely important. And I see a human body as being a human body, but it's really weird the way that, because some things have always been done in a certain way, you don't see that it's wrong. And I, you know, especially at the moment when it comes to the way that we treat attacks or violence caused by people who have darker skin, or as I saw someone on the BBC refer to it, someone that looked like they're of African descent, who looked African, which isn't a thing.
It's not actually a thing. I was going to say, sorry, that means what exactly?
Not a thing. But, you know, the way in which we try and send messages to viewers without saying the actual words. And I remember that there was an attack at Russell Square, that an American tourist had been attacked at Russell Square. And every single news network was calling the attacker, I believe it was a British national of Somali descent, is how they put it. And I just sort of walked in and I was incensed. I said, so how would you describe me? Would you describe me as, when someone says, oh, who's Charlie? Oh, she's a Black British. Or would you say she's Black British of Jamaican descent? Either I'm British or I'm not. What signals or signs are you trying to send here?
Yeah.
So when they talk about that individual at Russell Square, this is about sort of 6 years ago, I said, oh, well, you know, they might be Muslim. And they're like, well, so it might just be a terrorist attack. It's like, okay.
What, just because they're Muslim?
And I'm like, well, for a start, A, you don't know that he is. B, saying that somebody is of Somali descent, you understand that Islam is a religion, not a race. So the fact that the person is British is enough.
It's just a British man, right? That's fundamentally how we should be reporting this. And you're so right. The nuance in the language that we use, that's systemic.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that we can stop. But we, you know, you have to speak up. You have to become unpopular at work when you start challenging what is a system that's been in place, and people just groove along with it.
And that's where speaking for the voiceless comes into play. And I'm really lucky to be a senior member of the team now. But in terms of speaking up, it's something that I've always done because I don't see why I shouldn't. And I've always been very forthright because that's the way that I have been raised. I don't know how to do it any differently. And so when I see that something is wrong and something's just not working, then I will just say it. And again, you know, working in the newsroom that I work in, it's never, I would never say that it's gone down badly at all because of the way that I will deal with the situation, because you bring up a subject and it does make people think. And that's why having different people who think in slightly different way can only ever enrich a business, a newsroom, because actually you start questioning what it is that you're doing. I mean, I remember when there was a group of fantastic women who had circumvented the world, and they were the first group of women to ever do that. And I think somebody had written for me, the four mums who circumvented the world. And I was like, not reading that. I said, yeah, but they are mums. Really? Because when four men have done it, have you called them the four dads who circumvented?
Four dads. No.
And then they sit and then they think and they'll never do it again.
But exactly. You know, the number of times, Charlene, I get asked a lot in interviews, how do you juggle life as a single working parent? Well, like, would you ask single dads that question? No. Or people go, who's looking after the kids today? Well, you don't ask a guy
exactly.
That.
Like, working really? Dads, not it's... a thing. No one talks about the working dads. It's all about the working mums. It's like,
no.
Ugh.
Yeah. But equally, the language that we started to see really, actually, I felt was properly challenged via the media with the terrible murder of Sarah Everard, when the first rush of kind of, you know, of reporting and really sort of sitting around some of the stuff that had come from official police spokesmen was about how women should better protect themselves. It's like, no, hang on a minute. We're just getting home. How about you guys talk about how you can stop murdering and raping women? That's the conversation, not how we can do our very best to stay as well clear of you guys as possible. I mean, it's just incenses.
I know, but then it's interesting, isn't it? Because for generations, that's how those stories have been told. Mm. We have always been seen as being the one at fault. And we know that because historically, when it came to women being attacked, they'd be talking about what they were wearing and what their sexual activity had been like in the past. Because, of course, all those must be reasons why you're in the situation that you're in. And I think only now, you know, and I think social media does have a part to play in that, because I think a lot more women, we felt more empowered to expose the wrongs, to talk about the wrongs, to talk about language, to talk about blame in a way that perhaps wasn't heard before. Mm. And it's a really interesting moment in time that we're living in at the moment, where the fact that you are talking, you know, we're speaking up against a police constable, you know, a head of police, go, no, your advice should not be to women that they should, you know, perhaps they should be walking around in groups, or perhaps they should talk to a bus driver and get them to help them. It's like, no, you need to talk to the people who are doing the attacking. They are the ones that are at wrong.
Yes.
But for generations, exactly. We've been the ones at fault. We have been.
So, but, you know, I think, you know, clearly you've played a part in challenging the use of language, which is really, really important.
Yeah,
as we all attempt to change and shift our language and just become like a little bit more 2021.
Yeah, and also sort of think about the way in which we treat stories generally, the stories that, you know, would historically be brushed under the carpet because the child wasn't attractive enough, or the mum wasn't attractive enough, or, you know, all these reasons why, all these reasons that are given for not doing particular stories, or, you know, it's that story's a bit too black, or that story's a bit too South Asian, or that's all, oh, no, we don't want to do that. You know, all of those things that historically everyone's just gone, yeah, no, that's right, that's true. I've always been of the opinion is that it's just simply not.
It's not.
And my parents and my aunt have always challenged me every step of the way of at school and in my career, they've always challenged me. And so challenging other people and challenging what is seen as being the norm is actually something I enjoy.
But you're very good at it.
I think actually mixing things up a bit and getting things to people to think a bit more.
Yeah.
You know, that's the exciting thing about doing the jobs that we do. Doing things as they've always been done, there's no joy and excitement in that. But changing things up, mixing things up a bit, that's where the joy comes from.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you keep doing it. Keep shaking and moving. Before I move on to my next question, I just wanted to ask, what was it like when you were shooting Empire's Child, where you actually become the story?
You could see the shift. We're sort of halfway through the film, and I think that was when I travel to Jamaica, that's when everything switched. So throughout the first half, I was basically doing the whole, yeah, not going to get emotional. Yeah, I mean, I'm telling an important story, but it's also, you know, telling an important historical story and all those sorts of things. And yes, it's about my family, but I am still quite detached from it because I'm a journalist, blah, 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 nonsense. And then I flew out to Jamaica and it was just, something just took hold. There was something about being there. There was something about getting off that plane, breathing that air, and it's that warm, like, wall of air you walk into as you get off that plane that just suddenly hit me. And then it was at that moment I just thought, oh no, oh no. And I could feel like the journalist shackles sort of leaving me as I'm desperately trying to hold on to them. And it just didn't work at all, because suddenly being there in the place of my parents' birth and my grandparents' birth, it suddenly at that point became very personal. And I wanted to do right by them. And I had no idea what was coming. They weren't allowed to tell me what they found. So every time I sat down with an interviewee, they were telling me a completely new piece of information. And I had no idea what that was going to be. That was weird. it really was. And actually, one bit that wasn't in the film, and that the bit that really did set me off, was there's a poem by a Jamaican poet called Claude McKay. And the area Nairn's, the Nairn's estate that my family first bought land on when they became freed slaves, Claude McKay's parents also lived there. So Claude McKay was part of the Renaissance, the Harlem Renaissance. So he was a brilliant writer and essentially wrote this piece about leaving Clarendon. So that's the area that my family originate from. Mm. And it's a really short poem, but it's about leaving home, but it never actually ever leaving your heart. And that there's always going to be a connection. So they'd given me this poem when I was sat in the hotel and I read it. I was like, oh, yeah, that's nice. Didn't think anything of it. Stood at the top of this mountain, with this genealogist giving me all this information. She then hands me the book, opens it to this page and gets me to read it. I got to the end of it and just crumbled, because suddenly I realised this poem is about me. It's about anybody that has left, you know, their birthplace and moved elsewhere, even though it's not my birthplace, but my family, you know, and how you'll always feel that connection, whether you want to or not, you will always feel that connection. And standing on that mountain top, I felt that connection, read that poem, and suddenly it all suddenly made sense. Why I felt the way I did when I got off that plane, why my heart just was just, it just full and felt really weird. I felt weird. I didn't know why I felt weird. Read that poem and it suddenly all made sense, because I am forever connected to that piece of land. I'm forever connected to Jamaica. My kids will be forever connected to there. And read that poem and then that I literally just crumbled. And I fell into the producer's arms and then I'm going, I never do this. It's really weird.
And then you feel really unprofessional, don't you? And you're like, yeah. I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. I keep apologising. It's like,
yeah.
No, actually, it's really important to feel that. What you had was an entirely sensory connection to a story that is, well, inside of you. It is you. You are part of that story.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
I didn't expect it. And it was weird. It was weird. It was weird.
It was wonderful. Very powerful stuff. Now, I want to stick with Empire's Child to move on to my next question.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In the documentary, you meet the man who transformed your parents' fortunes after giving them lodgings when they arrived in the UK at a time when, let's be honest, very few would. It enabled them to get themselves eventually onto the property ladder and ultimately to build a prosperous future as a family. And this guy's 91 now. I loved it. You went to visit him. He still has the same stair carpet and it's pristine, by the way. I mean, has it been covered in plastic all these years or what?
They just don't make them like they used to, Kate.
But I wondered, do you have your own equivalent of him? Can you think of a time when an act of great support or kindness or faith was transformative for you?
Yeah, actually. It would be my first ever foray into TV, really, if we're talking sort of career stuff. Being a broadcast journalist and doing telly is what I've always wanted to do. And I wasn't really sure how to navigate that. And I was at Radio 1 and 1 Extra for a little while. I went on this roadshow and I was in Sheffield. And I didn't want to go to Sheffield to do this roadshow because I had a night out plan with my mates on the Saturday night. And I was going to that club and I was going to out with my mates and nothing was going to stop me. So I went up to Sheffield on the Friday, helped them to set up. And then on the Saturday, before the public came in, we had to test the auto cues. This guy said, oh, Charlene, and this other guy, girl, Hannah, can you get up on stage and just make sure we've got it at the right distance? We did that, finished that, was literally 5 minutes, went on with the rest of the roadshow. I left, got on the train back to London, went raving, didn't think anything of it.
Went rave. I love it.
Yeah, basically. They're like, are you not staying? No, I'm going out.
I'm raving. I'm out.
Yeah, basically. And then about 2 months later, I get this email. I'm sat in the office and I get this email and it turned out that the guy who was comparing, who'd asked me to get on stage, was the editor of BBC Three 60 Second News. And he said to me, so from the moment you walked in to the marquee to do the roadshow, he says, I knew there was something different. He said, so I got you to get up on stage to read the auto cue because I just wanted to make sure. And I'd like you to come in and do a screen test.
Wow.
What? And I went in, read like 60 seconds of news. I got out of the studio from doing the screen test and he just went, have you got your diary so we can start booking you for shifts?
That stuff never happens anymore now, does it? You have to have 85 meetings with 35 agents and and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's quite a special person. His name is Nicky Shinnan. He's quite a special person. And at a time, obviously now everyone's sort of, especially since Black Lives Matter, wants to make sure that they fairly represent the country both on screen and off screen. And so looking for talented individuals that perhaps have been looked over in previous years. But one thing that Nicky did way before it became fashionable, way before it became a thing, is he wanted to make sure that 60 Second News was representative of the country. It was a youth service, obviously, it was a youth station. And he knew, and then, you know, we're going back to when I was, 25? So, you know, this is, 2005? And there are many, many people who were working on screen in the meet, including Claudia Lyser, who presents for Channel 5 News. He spotted each and every one of us in really different situations, saw something in us and brought us into the fold. And many of us wouldn't have on-screen careers if it wasn't for him. He was amazing. Before, you know, he saw that he was in a position of power and an authority, and he changed the lives for so many of us.
Oh.
And I'm forever he didn't have to do it. He wasn't forced to do it. He wanted to do it. And that completely changed the course of my career.
So where were you working at the time? Were you doing One Extra?
Yeah, I was doing One Extra and Radio One. And I love radio, but TV was always my goal. And it always just seemed to be a bit of a closed shop, really. I wouldn't say, you know, I didn't go to Oxbridge. I don't have like a super posh, you know, received pronunciation accent. I don't come from a family of media people. So it just seemed out of reach. Radio 1 didn't seem that out of reach to me because it was young people, and especially One Extra.
Yeah.
You know, it was a fantastic, fantastic station that was full. I've never worked with so many ethnic minorities before in my life. It was incredible. And actually, it had the effect of making me think that that's what all of media was like. So when I left there and went on elsewhere, and I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because you kind of glide through your childhood, forming your own ideas about what the world is going to be like for you. And then when you step out there and you realise that somewhere like One Extra was probably incredibly diverse in comparison to other newsrooms around the country. I mean, I'd never really understood what sexism was until I went to work. Mm. Then I got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But also I would find it quite shocking. I remember being away on an away day with all the other editors in the group, and they were all male. And all lovely, by the way, but there was the expectation of anyone fancy a cup of tea? Right, Kate, 12 teas, please. And I'm like, sorry?
Oh, my God.
No. It was stuff, just, you know, nothing horrible, but just
the nuances,
assumed.
It?
It's the nuances.
You know, yeah. And no one can prepare you for that.
No.
At all, because you sort of, school and college and uni, it's like, you know, everything seems balanced, you know, and then they put you out into the open world. And then that's when reality kind of hits you.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure anyone can truly prepare you for that. And it is really much a sink and swim.
Yeah.
You know, what was amazing is we all worked in this incredible environment at One Extra where we could go down to Soho and go to Mr. Jerk's and someone would buy, I don't know, a curry goat and rice and peas for lunch, come back, and the reaction would be, oh my God, what is that? What's that smell? You know, as you may do in other newsrooms, the reaction would be, I cannot believe you've gone to Mr. Jerks and didn't tell anyone and take an order. You know, that would be the reaction. And I think part of me being who I am was also shaped by being there too, because I never had to second guess myself in terms of thinking, if I suggest this story, is this going to be seen as too black? If I talk in this particular way, will people take me less seriously? If I turn up to work wearing, I don't know, Air Force Ones or something, will they see me as being a bit of a joke? I never had to think about any of those things because we're working in an environment where we're all very much like each other. So I never had to have a filter. I only then had to have a filter when I then started working elsewhere. But by that point, I was old enough to not really care about having a filter and having to step on, you know, walk on eggshells so as not to upset anybody.
You were able to grow as you rather than conforming into some kind of expectation that people have of, you know, identikit Stepford wife style journalists in newsrooms.
Yeah.
So actually that One Extra Radio 1 environment was probably really important to the professional you grew up to be.
Yeah, 110%. The way I write is very different because I remember our editor would always say, write as though we're sat in the pub over a pint and you're telling me a story. That's the way that we write news. So that's the way I write now, even now. And when I'm talking with the younger members of my team, that's how I tell them to write as well. I said, don't write how you think you should be writing. Just write as you. For me, as a broadcaster, I feel what was important for me is to always just sound like me. And I did fight quite hard for that. You know, especially with doing really high profile programs like News at 10, for example, I still do it as me. I still change words. I still change sentences because I just want to, irrespective of whether I'm doing Loose, News at 10, Evening News, whatever I'm doing, I want everyone to know it's just me, you know?
Tom Bradby, when he started News at 10, felt like a really dangerous walk on the wild side because he didn't read the news. He presented the news. It's a difference. You know, you're not a news reader. What do they call that role now? You're an anchor, you're...
And it's just sort of...
A newscaster, if we're American.
A newscaster, yeah. But newscaster. There's room for different styles. I just think... Yeah. the days of feeling like British news can only ever be presented or hosted or read in only ever one way, those days are gone, you know?
Long gone.
Yeah, and I think it's I would hate, and I think this is also a Radio 1 throwback, it's for years the assumption was that young people weren't interested in news. I mean, the number of people that would listen to Radio 1 and One Extra, to those Newsweek programmes on a daily basis, very clearly told you that's not true.
That's not
and
true.
And we've gone through years of grown-up news ignoring younger people and now sort of desperately trying to galvanise them and get them interested in what they're doing. Like, we can't, you know, if we do things in the same way, you're not going to bring them in. And it's so important that we bring them in.
Definitely.
Because, you know, they have to, you have got all these ways of learning about the world now, but the trusted ways to learn about the world, you know, there are still few of those places that when there's breaking stories that you can really go to and trust in the fact that you're getting the truth.
Mm.
You start losing young people to those sources, then things get messed up a bit. And knowing more. Mm.
And I think it's really important that they know where they have to come for news that's when I say regulated, answerable to an Ofcom that has a duty to present the facts as opposed to opinions.
Exactly.
So that people can form their own opinions. That's really important. And, you know, and actually my son's 13. If he didn't live with such a news junkie, he wouldn't know what the BBC News was, for example, yeah, or the ITN News. So I think, you know, we've really got to, they are incredibly powerful and meaningful, and we need them to be there. And we learned that so much in the pandemic.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the news became the new prime
time.
Yeah,
and I think, and that proved just how important those services still are, because millions of people every night during, especially that first lockdown, you know, they wanted to know what was happening. They needed to know what was happening because we're all sat in this awful situation and we're scared and we don't know what to do. And we've seen how dangerous those unregulated news sources can be. Hugely dangerous.
Mm. Yeah, and I think actually you become more important than ever because you've for the day, you know, we would be swimming through this kind of quagmire of news sources and opinions on social media. But actually the stuff that makes those big news bulletins is the stuff that's been qualified and clarified, and therefore that's important.
And I think people also have to recognise their own mental health and how dangerous consuming news every hour, every minute of every day can be. And the fact that the way that we do it is we are protecting your mental health. And I'll use this, you know, to go back to Sarah Everard, I'll use that as an example. When the police released a lot of their footage, once he had pleaded guilty and the court case was finished, there was a lot of stuff that was, footage that was released that we had on news programmes, obviously. But then on individual Instagram accounts and Twitter accounts, people were posting up the videos of when he was first interviewed, for example. They were doing all of that stuff. So you'd just be scrolling through and you'd see it time and time and time again. And it got to a point, like, actually, I can't look at my Instagram and my Twitter today because I haven't asked to see all of that stuff. There is no warning before I see all of that stuff. It's, you know, you see the picture and the video first, then you see the words. Then it's like, oh, it's a trigger warning, but I've already seen it.
Yeah.
Before your words. Whereas when we do it, we say, before we show you anything, you might find this disturbing. We are giving you a chance to opt out if you don't want to see what it is that we're broadcasting.
There's a governance to it.
Yeah. If people are scrolling through those videos and that footage all day, every day, that has an effect on somebody's mental health. And I don't think
it does.
That people really quite understand when they sort of talk about the media, which is not one homogenous thing anyway, but when they talk about the media, well, every time you post these things up on your accounts, you are becoming a part of that, but unregulated. And you're not giving somebody a choice as to whether they see it, whether they engage with it, or you have no idea what impact that's going to have on an individual.
Can they handle it?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's something I'm really passionate about, is people understanding their own mental health when news is concerned.
You're quite right. I think social media has got a lot to do if it's going to remain pertinent and important, but not damaging.
Yeah. And I think for individuals, just think a little bit more about what it is that they're posting what you're sharing. Because there are news sources around where if you want to watch something, you can, but it doesn't mean that everybody needs to, Because what is it that you're gaining from doing that? You know, you can have like 1,000 people all sharing that video of him first being interviewed. And it's like, you don't all need to do that. You also need to understand that you also as an individual have a responsibility. And I don't necessarily think people are yet seeing it in that way. So I will never just...
But again, is that not down to language, do you think? Because I don't think people realise that the moment you open a Twitter account, a Facebook page, an Instagram account, you are a publisher.
No, I don't think they realise that.
That is what you are.
They don't realise that at all.
Yeah, so if that's what it's... And this is what I keep saying to my son. Every time you hit that share button, you're publishing content about your life. There's a digital footprint that remains there forever. You have to really want to own that moment to share it.
Yeah.
It's tricky. The lessons are long, hard, and very much ongoing, aren't they?
They really are. Yeah. They are, and it's not going away anytime soon.
It's just a question that leads to a question that leads to a question. Which, speaking of which, I've got my last question for you. This is your third and final question. I wanted to know, when you last made a decision that was completely out of character and unlike you, but then went on to pay great dividends?
I'll leave it on a high note. I would say the outfit that I just wore to Pride of Britain Awards. Completely.
Oh, I saw that. Red hot jumpsuit, by the way, looking fiercely
completely
boxy.
Completely out of my comfort zone.
Was it?
Completely out of my comfort. I mean, like in my 20s, going to clubs. Yeah, totally in my comfort zone. But as in my 30s and becoming a mum, and then in my 40s and, you know, older and not as skinny and all those sorts of things, very much out of my comfort zone. But I made, a friend suggested to me that I wear it. And I thought, do you know what? I'm just going to do it. And even when all my friends were here and helping me to get dressed and stuff, and my friend was just saying, Charlotte, it's going to be fine. And I really wasn't like dancing around and being happy, what have you. And I tentatively tried it on. I thought, yeah, this could maybe work. And I'm like, look, just get your hair done, do the makeup, and I promise you, you'll be fine. And I was completely out of my comfort zone. And I'd actually looked in my wardrobe to see if there was an alternative just in case. And actually, it was the collective power of my friends going, it's fine. And my sister going, you look beautiful, that actually got me to walk out of the house wearing it. And then I was walking down the red carpet and I did feel fabulous. And I think despite the fact that I'm...
Because you looked it.
Thank you. I mean, despite the fact that I'm obviously on telly every day, I still do have my own insecurities. And those are manifested after you've had kids. And I think especially when you have kids slightly later in life, you know, things don't go away as quickly as they perhaps would have done if I'd had kids earlier.
Oh, God, no.
You know, you do end up getting, you know, getting all up in your own head about stuff. And I wouldn't normally, that was very much out of my comfort zone. And then by the time I got out that taxi on the red carpet, I was like, no, it's fine. I'll be fine. This is fine. And then had a glass of champagne and then everything was fine. So
everything was fine after that. Do you know, isn't it funny that a jumpsuit is more likely to destabilise you than some sort of major news event? Isn't it funny?
Because news, I've been doing,
like,
news,
you know,
for
you,
so
you
long.
Could throw you on air to cover a disaster and you'd cope, but you're going, oh, a jumpsuit, I don't know. Oh God,
it's
is this me?
Isn't it?
But when you look at it like that, but no, it's not, because I hear you, I get you, I totally understand you. I think we're all massively vulnerable, and that's okay.
Yeah, I think, that's a lesson that I learn as well. And all this kind of doing red carpet stuff, it's all very new to me. It's
new, right?
It's, you know, it's only sort of become a thing since doing Loose Women. So it's all so new and still quite scary and... You know, you never know if you're...
I mean, that
right
in itself
decision.
Could qualify as a decision that's most unlike you and out of character to join Loose Women. Is it something you had to give a lot of thought to?
No, but that, to me, that's not out of character. It's so weird because people always say that to me and they think it's very much out of character, but it's not. It's an extension of me. It's me sitting with my mates having a conversation about news stories, which is what I do anyway. There just happens to be a camera in front of me, you know, and just having a laugh and a joke. My thing has always been is... You know, yes, I'm a geek for news and I love news, but that's not the entirety of me. And I've always said that. And And, you know, I'm really, really lucky that ITV have allowed me to show that and to use that and to, you know, and I love doing it, but it's not out of the comfort.
It's a great show to
do,
isn't it?
Brilliant, you know?
It's really sad to me that there's still only one talk show on television dedicated to female voices.
Oh, because
that really
women,
is not
women
right.
Don't care, Kate. You know, women don't really care about all of that stuff. They don't care. You know, it's amazing the
put
way...
Put me in a room with someone saying that. Come on, let's go. Yes, we
you
do.
Know, it's you know, it comes down to so many things where women are concerned and, you know, the importance of who we are and the brains that are in our heads and our ability to navigate situations and our intelligence, you know, in so many different industries is always underestimated.
Always.
You know, and people make assumptions about what it is that we want. And this podcast is a good example of how wrong that is, you know.
And I think there's great benefit in these conversations. And I think people take a lot from them. So maybe that kind of DIY culture has a lot to be said for it. As well.
I talk myself around in circles on that one. No, but what this has encouraged, all these platforms have encouraged, you know, entrepreneurs like yourself. And I think we are going through a moment in time where that level of entrepreneurism is the future, you know? And we can see that through influencers, for example, who work very hard in their careers online, all these sort of people who are essentially entrepreneurs. They may not necessarily have the respect levels that they should get for their work, but the reality is they're entrepreneurs, and that should only ever be celebrated.
Do you think of yourself as one?
No. I have a short attention span, Kate. So as much as I'd love to sort of go out and do it alone and look, I always have ideas. I'm like an ideas person. But as all my school reports all say, I'm great at the idea, really bad with the follow through. So I would, you know.
Yeah, but that's fine. You can just populate teams to pick up on all this. The thing is, we should know we're not all good at everything, right? And an ideas person and a creator, an originator, that's valuable. And also I would argue that as somebody that has multiple irons in multiple fires, you are already very much an entrepreneur.
Thank you Kate, you're good for the soul, man.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm also good for the dance floor, and that's where I'd like to see you next time. If anybody would like to go back and revisit your incredible journey with Empire's Child, I would implore them to do so. It's on ITV Hub. It's available on Catch Up. Please go and watch it. You'll learn an awful lot about the history that should have been taught in our classrooms. Still really isn't, but hopefully is about to be. And that's the story of all of us, the people that make up this great nation that we so boldly called Great Britain.
Yes. Thanks, Kate. Thank you.
That's it for this week's White Wine Question Time. As always, the show's produced by me, Kate Thornton, alongside Gabriella Colasurdo, Richard Hatherell, and Libby Knowles for Yahoo UK. Our beats come courtesy of Andy Bell. I'll be back next week. Until then, take great care out there.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.